I just met our speaker last night. It's Chuck L. from the Brookhaven Group of Columbus. And we kind of check out his story against what his wife said this morning. Maybe he'll tell us a little more. I want to introduce you now to Chuck L. from Columbus.
Thank you, Archie. I'm Chuck Lanham, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and this great program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sober today. My eyes are a little bloodshot, but it's not from the booze, it's from Debbie. In case you all didn't know it, that was Debbie's first public appearance. This was her first talk, and I thought she did a wonderful job. I believe that what I read recently, that I forgot where I read it, but it said that if you remember the first drink you ever took, there's a good chance you're an alcoholic. And until I read that, I hadn't even thought about it, but I sure remember the first drink that I took. I feel a little embarrassed talking about it because being in AA a little while and hearing so many stories about people start drinking when they were 14 or 15, I've heard a couple 10 or 11, and some getting in their mother's cooking sherry when they were 6 or 7. But I really didn't start drinking until I was 20 years old. And then one New Year's Eve, this group that people that I knew and associated with some time kind of explained to me what fun it was and that I should get involved in it. And this was in a little town up in Ohio. It was on a Sunday night. And in Ohio, you can't drink until midnight on Sunday night. 1 minute after one, all the nightclubs start operating again. But I remember the bartender going over to the bar in this little bar we were in and turning the clock. About 8 o'clock, he turned the clock around to 12. And there were three policemen sitting there watching it. So I think everybody in town did it that night. And then they ordered a drink for me, and I don't know, I had two or three, maybe four drinks at this bar. And I began to think I was real tough. I heard these guys talking about drinking somebody under the table, and I thought, well, I must be one of these guys that's going to drink everybody under the table. I've had three or four. I don't even feel it. Barely feel it. So we went to a party at someone's house, and I thought, I must be way behind everybody else. So I went back, and I poured about that much in a water glass and downed it. I thought, maybe this will help me catch up. I began to get a little glow, and so I decided, well, if that gives me a little glow, I need another about the same size. So I went back and fixed that water glass again and downed it. And all of a sudden, a few minutes later, it started getting awful hot in that house and the wall hit me. I remember them taking me, putting me in the car and taking me uptown, and God, I don't know why, but they gave me tomato juice. This was in the dead of winter in Ohio, and I don't know, it was about 5 above zero, and when that tomato juice went down, everything else came up. And this boy had borrowed his father's brand new automobile. And I initiated it. I christened it with this tomato juice and everything else, all over the dash, all over the floor. The boy wouldn't speak to me for 2 or 3 weeks later because his father told him he couldn't ever use a car again, period. But that was my first experience, and I thought, well, it slipped up on me. And I did learn after that I wasn't as tough as I thought I was, and I drank, but I didn't drink that much that quickly. But I can remember not too many months later, a friend of mine called Buck, my old drinking buddy in those days, I remember he and I on a Saturday night riding through town, and I happened to look out the window, and he was driving my car, and I saw a stop sign go by. I said, Buck, that's a stop sign. You just went through it. That's a highway going through there. He said, oh, that was yesterday. And I gave a big laugh, and that was real funny. This same fellow and I, we used to go to a nightclub on the outskirts of town, and this was one of those real nice nightclubs. They made you go outside to fight. You couldn't fight inside. And we had a bartender in there who was a good friend of ours. We could go in this nightclub. They had a good band, a good floor show. He and I could throw a dollar on the bar and sit there, and the bartender would keep mixing us drinks all night, would never pick the dollar up. The dollar was there in case the manager happened to look. when he served the drink, he'd pick up the dollar. Otherwise, we'd sit there and drink all night free. Well, Buck and I got in a little disagreement about something. I don't know what it was. And he invited me outside, or I invited him outside. And I do remember we had quite a fight. He was a little smaller than me, so I do remember being on top and really letting him have it. And Sunday morning, he called me up, and he was real upset with me. He wanted to know why I had let that fella beat the hell out of him last night. That was my old friend Buck. We were real fortunate that nothing serious happened to me during this period of time, because it wasn't too long after that that I went in the service, and I was sent up in the Aleutian Islands, and that kind of slowed down the drinking bit. I was a $21 a month private. I can see a few gray hairs in here that remember the $21 a month days. And bootleg booze in the Aleutian Islands. There were no bars down there. There's no one down there but us. And a few of the Air Force cargo people would bootleg some booze down there. It was $65 a fifth. And $21 a month and $65 a fifth, booze can't become a very big problem. But like a lot of other people, we found an answer. One of the boys in the medic started, he rat-holed a few barrels of medicinal alcohol back in the mountains, and he would sell that medicinal alcohol at $100 a gallon to our mess sergeant. The mess sergeant would put it in fifth bottles and sell it for $25 a fifth. Well, $25 a fifth for 180 proof alcohol is a lot better than $65 for some cheap blended whiskey. So here, after we had been up there a couple years in that theater, we didn't know when we were coming back. It was, except in a few occasions, it wasn't real dangerous to the ground troops up there. And a little drinking began to pick up a little bit. And we used to have these parties with this. We'd take this medicinal alcohol, and the only thing we had to mix it with was these lemon crystals they had in the mess hall, and water, and stick it outside for a while. It got cold quick. There was a writer from Time magazine came up there and attended one of our parties, and I read in his magazine when he came back what he named our concoction up there. He called it the Aleutian Solution. And that, we thought, was a solution to our problem. And as often as we could afford it or get it, we used it. And I came back to, I was up in there about 2.5 years. I came back to this country. I was stationed in Miami Beach for a while. That was quite a switch. And I had a buck sergeant's pay then. And a buck sergeant's pay in Miami Beach is about like $21 a month and $65 for booze. But I did learn to visit the nightclubs down there and go in and order one drink just before the floor show and see the floor show. And then get back out with the boys, and we'd have our jug someplace. I wasn't there. I was there about 6 months, I guess, and I got some more stinking thinking. The Battle of the Bulge was on, and I got real patriotic. I'd served a good bit of time overseas, and I figured that I was pretty safe unless the war got awfully bad. So I decided I wanted to go to infantry OCS, Fort Benning. I came to Fort Benning, and infantry OCS then is about like it is now. They don't even let you off the grounds hardly for a good bit of time. But here again, to show you how, even though booze was not a serious problem at the time, how it was becoming more of a problem. Because in the last week before you graduate, and at that time, if you came from another branch of the service, they had 2 months of pre-OCS. And then you had about 4 months of OCS. It was a long, hard pull. And the last week we were there, they let you go in town and buy uniforms. And this boy and I went in to buy, we already had uniforms. We went in because we'd been on water rationing, we were real thirsty, and we wanted to get a jug of rum. And the first jug was so good, we bought another jug, and first thing you know, we looked and it was an hour past time we were supposed to be in. So at the last of the course then, they didn't mind throwing you out or flunking you out, either one. We had to go find the officer of the day on Fort Benning and get him promised not to report us. So I climbed in bed about 2:30 in the morning. And at that time, they had at Fort Benning what they call a forced march. I forgot the exact figure, so many miles and so many minutes. And they did it on a moment's notice. And this is how I found a sure cure for a hangover. At 4 o'clock in the morning, they kicked us out for this forced march, full field pack. It was in July. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, it wasn't much cooler than it was at noon. And not only that, they made me platoon leader. I had to count the cadence while we were running, while we were walking. And about the first 3 miles, I did some praying. I prayed to go ahead and die. I figured that I was, and I'd just soon die and get it over with. But after about 4 miles, I began to come out of it. When we got back, I was soaking wet. And I don't know whether the pain of this helped or not, but we lost about 6 fellows that day that dropped out from heat prostration. When I came back and took a shower, and I felt like a new man. But later in my life, if I'd have tried that cure, I know I would have died that first 3 miles. But here again, I had worked hard for this to happen, and yet a couple jugs of booze, I almost blew the thing. I think that probably when I started drinking as a regular thing, when I got out of the service and I married Nancy and I went to work for NEI Corporation, which is RC Cola Company now, and as a special sales representative, it's kind of a troubleshooter to various plants throughout the southeast, all the way up to Binghamton, New York, that had problems. And I would be up early in the morning. Bottling plants start early in the morning. And in the summer, it would be late at night, and I'd come back to the hotel, and I'd be tired, and I'd feel sorry for myself, and I knew I had to do it again the next day. And I started this thing of taking a drink every night. Didn't take too long before it was a habit. I began to be a little concerned about it. I thought, well, I'm working hard, and I did apply myself, and I didn't complain about being out. I think one time I was away from home 3 months because I'd gotten something I couldn't turn loose. And it was shortly after that they made me a district manager. And at that time I was 29. The average age of a district manager was about 55 or 56. I was kind of the child prodigy of the sales manager of the company. Everybody was waiting for me to fall on my face, and I knew it. So I applied myself diligently. I worked hard at this district job, and I thought, well, with this district job, I'll be home on weekends, most weekends, and that'll kind of take the edge off of the loneliness of being in a hotel room all week. But as we all know, that wasn't the answer. By really working hard, and that it hadn't affected my work at this time, that I was promoted down North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland area, a much bigger territory. But it had a lot of problems there, and that's the reason that I was offered promotion, more money, because they thought I could solve these problems. And being still this child prodigy, I thought I was going to solve all these problems overnight. And I worked hard, and I drank hard. I ended up in Duke Hospital with blood pressure of something over 260. The guy said I could have had a stroke any minute. And here again, I was blaming the work and not the booze. The work may have contributed to it. It was about this time that I went to a doctor in Chapel Hill. One weekend, on Monday, I got up, and I never had this nervous feeling before. And I went to this doctor, and he was a heck of a nice fellow. He's a general practitioner, and when I was on traveling and Nancy became sick, and one night he came and spent the night there. And there's not many doctors that even make a house call, much less spend the night in your home. And he did because she was very sick with a strep throat. I had a lot of respect for this guy, and I said, he said, I think no doubt booze is your problem right here. And he said, I said, well, if it is, he said, I think you're an alcoholic, or you're going to be soon. And I said, well, if so, what do I do? And he mentioned a mental institution up the road, shock treatments, and a few things like that. And I had a friend that had taken these shock treatments, not for drinking, but for a mental problem. And the way he described them, I didn't want any point of that, so I thanked him, took his paraldehyde for a couple of days, and went on my way. But within a few months, I was back in the same fix, and I figured that, like we do, that this job was causing all my troubles. I worked too hard. And I was doing well with the company, and I had a good reputation with the company. But recently, my supervisor, a division manager, had on a meeting in Columbus called me in and said, I thought I smelled booze on your breath one morning when I was up in your territory. Told the typical lie. I said, well, you know, we're out the night before, a lot of drinking, you can smell it the next day sometime. And one more time, he called me in and he showed me an article in Reader's Digest about ant abuse. And, of course, here again, I said, well, I may drink a little too much now and then, but it's not really a problem with me. This guy really had my interests at heart and he wanted to help me. He just didn't know what to do. So I figured, well, I still haven't got myself in trouble, so I'll just quit this job and do something else where I can be home every night. As we all know, that didn't solve the problem, and this was typical timing for an alcoholic. This was the first year that my firm offered stock options to the executives and the district managers. And with the price of RC Cola today, and the options that I would have had in the next 6 years after I left, I walked away leaving about $350,000 laying on the table. That's not the value of the stock, it would have been the profit in the stock. So here is a guy that works 10 years hard with a company, really applied himself, and because of his drinking problem and his stupidity about how to solve the drinking problem, blows the one chance he has at having a few dollars in his pocket. If I had that $350,000 today, my net worth would be approximately $350,000. If Nancy hadn't spent any of it. But during this period of time, I came back not knowing what I was going to do. I did get a real estate license, and I had a bad hangover when I took it, but I passed it. It wasn't that difficult. And about this time, my father became ill, and he had leukemia. He'd been ill for a couple years, but it took a long time for him to determine that he had leukemia. And I went to visit him and took my son, and we came back because the doctor turned out the doctor used to be our newsboy. He's a good friend of mine, and he said it may be 6 months, it may be 3 months, it may be 9 months. There's no way to tell. But I came home, and I was real concerned. I love my father. And about 2 months later, he died, and so I started up there myself. And we had about used up the savings we had when I had quit, so I jumped in an old automobile we had and got a tank full of gas and 3 or 4 quarts of vodka and took off. And when I got to Charleston, West Virginia, which we had lived at one time, I knew that I was at the point where I should quit driving. I did a lot of drunk driving. If I had to serve the time for every time I should have been arrested for drunk driving, I'd be there the rest of my life. When I pulled over to the side of the road, and the condition I was in, there's a freeway that goes through the middle of Charleston with a park in the middle. Instead of pulling in a driveway or an alley or off the street, I just parked over on the side. And about an hour later, roughly, I guess, the police pulled me out of the car, shook me, and took me to the pokey. And I laid there in the drunk tank, and it was a typical drunk tank. It stunk. There was no bathroom in there. People were going to the bathroom, but there wasn't any in there. And as soon as I could get the jailer's attention and the fuzz got out of my mind, I told him, I said, I'm going to my father's funeral, and I need to get out of here right quick. And, of course, they had heard better stories than that. Mine didn't register. Finally, about 8 o'clock, they did let me say I could make one phone call. And I remembered a person that lived there that might still live there, and I called and fortunately got them on the phone. They come down and bailed me out. And, of course, I told this person what lousy cops they had there, pulling a poor old fellow off out of his car and throwing him in jail just because he's trying to get off the road because he was sleepy. But I made my father's funeral. You can imagine the condition I was in. But here I couldn't even get from Columbus to my father's funeral without getting drunk. Shortly after this, I went to work for the people I work for today, Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. A friend of mine that works for them hired me. He's one of my good friends that didn't know I was an alcoholic. But, he knew I drank with him sometimes, but I was As John Mooney says, alcoholism is controlled and uncontrolled drinking. And there were periods that I had good control, especially at social gatherings. I could control it. After I got home, I may have let my hair down, but I could control it then. But there was four months training in New York. And there's a couple mornings. I walked in there with booze on my breath. I tried to avoid it. I did everything I could, but sometimes it got where I had to have it to keep from shaking to death to go to school. It's a tough course, and I had to study a lot harder than the other fellows, but I made it through. And I figured, well, when I get back home, this is, I've got a good job now. It has a good future. It's a job I like. It's a business I'm interested in, and everything's going to be all right. But as you know, it wasn't. It wasn't too long before many mornings I had to have the morning drink. I'd get up real early in the morning. And I don't know, I tried many times. I don't think I ever succeeded, but I used to keep the vodka in the shower stall, and I'd get up and sit on the john and reach around the shower stall and try to pick that bottle up without banging the side of the wall where Nancy could hear me. And I don't think I ever succeeded. But I had to have enough vodka to quit shaking and to eat breakfast so I wouldn't stink so bad, I thought, to go to work. About 11 o'clock, 11:30, somewhere around there, it got to the point where I had to have something. And my bar was the Palace Pool Room. I couldn't drink it out front there because they only served beer, and there's too many people I knew in there anyway. But you go to the Palace Pool Room, for those of you who don't know, it's right downtown Columbus. It's across from my office. They have the best hot dogs in town. I don't know what it is, the beer fumes and the smoke and the sweat from the guy that's mixing the chili that does it, but it's the best chili in town. The restaurant stinks. The pool room is worse. And the John was my bar. I had a bottle of vodka hidden behind a metal door that swung back against the wall. I'd go in there early in the morning and stash it away so that at 11 o'clock or about that time, I could go in and have a transfusion enough to last until I go to lunch about 12:30 or 1. And I was talking to J.W. about booze a little while ago, and he was talking about his wild turkey was 102 proof, and I told him that vodka I drank was 100 proof, and he said that he could even drink wild turkey straight with a little chaser. And I said, man, I've drunk a lot of 100 proof vodka straight with a cigarette. And I said, I've drunk it straight at about, I think, 200 degrees temperature. As I leave it in the car, everybody wonder why I wouldn't park in the parking lot like everybody else. But at lunchtime, I get in my car. I got to go to lunch someplace else. And that car had been parked out in the sun in the summertime, and that 100-proof vodka, I think the temperature was close to 200 degrees. I would take a big slug, and the sweat would pop out on my face. I'd turn the air conditioner on and run around so I wouldn't go back in the office soaking wet. About this time that we had a trip to Florida and took the kids, and down there I figured this was my vacation. I didn't have to worry about what time it was to take a drink, so any time of the day or night I was taking a drink, except when I wasn't awake or passed out. And I came back knowing that something had to be done. I was in bad shape physically. So that Monday night I went to a doctor in town and told him I have a problem and I want to do something about it. What can you do for me? He said, well, we have to put you in the hospital to shape you in to withdraw you. And I agreed, and I said, I'll make it till Friday so I won't have to be off work too much. And he put me in the hospital, and except for some severe abdominal pains, which I think was my liver, because he did a liver function test, and it's the first one I'd had. I was afraid to take one before that or even ask about it. I had severe liver damage, and I suspected that. And he kept telling me every day he'd come in, you only got one liver. When you drink that one up, you're through. That's it. He said, all you have to remember is don't take the first drink. And I thought, well, finally, here's a guy with the answer. And through fear alone, I stayed sober 9 months. Fear about my liver. And this don't take the first drink thing made a little sense. But I don't think anyone but another alcoholic would know why someone would go out and take a drink after he'd been sober 9 months. My life was a little better. It wasn't contented sobriety, but I was dry. We didn't have as many problems. My family didn't have quite as many problems with me. And within a short period of time, I was in bad shape again. I called him to my house. He came and gave me a shot in the fanny and said, "Don't ever call me again. There's nothing I can do for you." Well, you can imagine what I called him, and Nancy wasn't in Al-Anon then either, and you should have heard what she called him. If anybody had paid any attention to us, they'd probably thrown him out of the medical profession. But I know today that this guy didn't know what to do, period, other than tell me not to take the first drink. So I got in bad shape physically, and I know he wouldn't, and I'd worn out two or three other doctors that said, "Don't call me, I'll call you." And I had heard of Bronner's up near Smyrna, in Smyrna, Georgia, and I decided to go to Bronner's. I didn't know what it was. I just knew they dried people out, and that it was a psychiatric clinic. And I called a couple doctors to get me in. They said, "There's no room." And I said, "Well, I'm sure there's room up there in a big place like that." So during that day, I kept trying to drink to try to get back to feeling normal. I, long before that, quit worrying about feeling gay or good. I was just trying to feel normal, and I couldn't. The booze wasn't doing me any good. So late that afternoon, I threw a bag in the car, and I took off for Smyrna. And when I got there, I went in. I said, "Here I am. What are you going to do about it?" They said, "We've been expecting you. Wife's been calling every half hour." It took me about 6.5 hours to drive from Columbus to Smyrna, which is just outside of Georgia, of Atlanta. I would drive a while. I'd have to park a while. I'd get out and walk a while, and then I'd get back in, and I'd start driving. I'd get so nervous. I couldn't hold a wheel. I'd stop, and I'd try to lie down. I couldn't lie down, but this was this process. This fellow was on night duty there was real nice. He took me in and gave me something real strong and knocked me out. I found out later why he was so nice to me. He was an alcoholic. He died about 2 months ago, someone told me recently. But I found out that the boozers at Bronner's are thrown in with the rest of the people with mental problems. That kind of shook me up once I found out. For a while, I didn't know didn't make much difference one from the other. But after a few days, I could find out that the boozers were getting sober and the other people that just had mental problems. And it kind of shook me up. I think after about 4 days, they let me use my own matches to light my cigarettes. They were reducing the medication. They ease you off up there real nice and real beautiful. And they let me go in the dining room. And I went in and sat down with a couple of fellows my age, and I struck up a conversation. I'd be here a little while. I'd like to get to know somebody. And I talked to one fellow. He was a very prominent pediatrician in Atlanta. And I said, what the devil are you here for? He said, "Same as you." We were dressed in pajamas and bathrobe. And the other fellow, I said, "What about you?" He said, "I'm a Catholic priest from so-and-so in South Georgia." I said, "What are you here for?" He said, "Same thing as you." It was the first time I think I really got serious about this problem that I had, because I figured here's a doctor that has access to drugs and other doctors and probably has some friends that are psychiatrists, and this guy don't know what to do. Here's another man that is supposedly close to God, a man of the cloth, and he don't know what to do. What's a little poor old country boy from Columbus going to do? I asked to get out early, and I found I was lucky that I committed myself, because if Nancy had gone with me and committed me, I may still be there. But if you commit yourself, you can get out. They let me out with a promise that I would go to the Bradley Center, which is a psychiatric clinic in Columbus. I did. I went and saw Dr. Mahalik at the Bradley Center, and I said, "Now, I've been in this funny farm up here." I said, it's really shook me up. And I said, "I know that I have to quit drinking now. I'm sincere about this." And I said, "I'm going to do it, period." He said, "All right, but if you find you can't, come back." It took me a year. That sobering up experience kept me sober about 8 months. On fear of they took another liver function test, and naturally it ain't got any better. And the fear of being in a mental institution, that scared me. But here again, not too long, I was experimenting again. And then I went back to the psychiatrist almost a year later, and I told him, I said, I was wrong. I thought I could do it, but I can't. I did it for 8 months, but now I'm back in the same rut, and I go for a while, and I force myself to quit, and that's 3 or 4 days of suffering, and but then I find I'm back again. So he said, well, he said, I would suggest two things. He said, first, I would suggest you go to AA. And I said, all right. He said, St. Thomas Episcopal Church group, it's a winning group, meets over here at this address, and it's not too far from where you live. And he said, I'd almost bet you money that you recognize some people when you walk in the door. And he said, come here for psychiatric treatment. Well, a month later, he asked me how I was doing in AA, and I said, I didn't go. I said, I'm a stockbroker, and I deal with people's money, in some instances, a lot of money. They depend on me for advice. And I said, if these people are here, I'm out there associating with a bunch of drunks, I'd be out of business. And that's the way I felt. And I'm sorry that he didn't argue with me there, but he just dismissed it. I wish he had argued with me and told me a little more about AA. But I went on with his head shrinker, and sometimes in AA we criticize psychiatry, and I certainly don't, because I think he did some things to help me, other than didn't help my drinking problem, but some other things I think he helped me with. But that guy couldn't help me much, because we all know an alcoholic is an excellent liar. And after about 2 months, I used to jazz up the sessions a little bit. I'd leave the office early, made my sessions late in the afternoon so it wouldn't interfere with my work so much. And I go by and drink a half a pint or so of vodka to get this conversation a little more, give a little more stimulation. And he didn't have any couch. He's one of those modern guys with just a chair, but we sat across the room from each other. He couldn't smell me over there, and I don't think he ever knew I was drinking. I never got drunk. I was just trying to get feeling a little better before I had to go see him. And I don't know who was snowing who under there. One day he told me, he said, man, you're really sharp. And I went home one day, and I figured, you've barked up a lot of trees, and you've tried a lot of things, and you're trying another one, but if you have to go and get half-loaded to go to see your psychiatrist to talk about your drinking problem, that ain't your answer. And he didn't get any honest answers out of me, period. And God knows what all I told him. He's the one that told me to take the cruise. That's the reason I liked him. He didn't tell me how to get up to scratch to take the cruise, but he said, take a cruise. But he was a real nice fellow, and when I wrote him and told him that I wasn't coming back, that I was going to try AA, he sent me a very nice letter and wished me a lot of success. And I went home that Monday, and I called AA, and within 20 minutes, Bill C. was knocking at my door. And Bill I had known not real well, and I know that he drank a little booze now and then. I know he had some problems, but I didn't know that they were that bad. He told me a little about his story, and I can see now, after doing a little 12-step work, what he was trying to find out. Do you think you're an alcoholic? Finally, I got the message, and I said, that's not my problem. I said, I know I'm an alcoholic. I said, many doctors have told me, and if that wasn't right, I said, Nancy's probably told me 10 or 12,000 times herself. And I said, down deep, I know that I'm an alcoholic. I may not know a good description of an alcoholic, but I know that I have a serious problem. And he said, well, he said, I suggest you come to a meeting. And he said, I suggest you come to several. And he said, I suggest you come with an open mind, not a closed mind, and listen. And suggested that Nancy go to Al-Anon. I said, man, I'm ready for anything. I said, I've tried everything I know, and I'm down at the bottom of the barrel. I have to do something. So he picked me up and Nancy up, and we went to the first AA meeting. I clarified it that afternoon. I told him, I said, I've been drinking since I got off work. I said, I got a drink to keep from shaking. And I said, I'm not trying to get drunk. I'm just trying to keep from shaking to death. And he said, come anyway. So I'm thankful that in that group they scratched out that little thing that used to be in some of these preambles about you have to be sober when you walk in the door. Because if that were true, maybe I would never have gone to that group. But I don't remember a lot about the first meeting, except I do remember the same thing that Nancy does, the love that I could feel these people had for me in this room. A couple I did know. Many of them I didn't know. And the only thing these people had an interest in, as far as I was concerned, was an interest in helping me. And I had a lot of people wanting to help me before, but usually they either had one or two hands in my pocket when they were trying to help me. But these people didn't want anything from me. They said, the only thing you need to be here is that you want to quit drinking. Thank God that night somebody slipped a big book under my arm as I walked out the door. And I went home and I read it. And I tried to drink no more than I had to keep from shaking. And I read most of the big book that night. And it made a lot of sense to me. I could understand a little about myself. I found that alcoholism was a disease, that it was physical, mental, and spiritual. I figured they left one out, and that was financially sick, because I show what? But I could see the physical and the mental, because I was physically ill, and I had been on and off for several years. Mentally ill, I'd already committed myself to mental institutions. I couldn't argue with that one. The spiritual part I hadn't even thought about. It hadn't entered my mind. But I thought back in one of the sessions with a psychiatrist. We talked about something I thought was missing in my life. I didn't know what. And I said, I go to this church once in a while, but that minister's no good. And I said, there's a minister in another church I see on TV. He's pretty good. He said, well, why don't you go to the other one? Well, that made sense, but I didn't go there either. The spiritual thing didn't bug me. I didn't understand it, but the others I could understand. They made sense. So I came back on Thursday night, and I said, I've read the big book, and I've read some other literature you gave me, and I think I'm in the right place. I said, I hope I'm in the right place. I don't know where else to go. And I said, I want to try AA. But I said, right now, I'm in such a shape physically, I don't know whether I can stop without going to the hospital or not. And I said, I don't know any doctor here that'll put me in the hospital. And we had a little advisory session after the meeting, and some of the people there, and they suggested that I try it on my own. And they said, don't worry about getting in the hospital. He said, if you can't make it on your own, we'll get you in the hospital. So with that assurance, I went home to do it on my own. And this was the first time that I had ever been in this shape physically and tried to get off of it myself. I'd always gone and found some doctor, some hospital, some place to get me off the hook. I didn't sleep for 5 days and five nights. I walked from one end of the house to the other. I couldn't lie down. For a few minutes, I'd have to be up. I couldn't sit down very long. I couldn't hold anything on my stomach. I couldn't drink coffee. I could sip a little water. And for me, I don't know about anybody else, but for me, I think I needed that. Not to have an easy job of coming out of it one time, to help me remember what it was like. Because I never have been so miserable at any time in my life as I was those 5 days. Nancy had only attended 2 Al-Anon meetings, and she said she didn't say anything, but she must have heard something, because all she did was stay out of my way. And I went to the next meeting, and I said, I'm sober, but I sure am in bad shape. And one of the old-timers there, Ray L., which a lot of you know, he said, Chuck, said, how long did it take you to get in the fix you's in? I said, I don't know. My mind was still fuzzy. I said, 25 years or so. He said, you don't expect to get all that out of the way in 5 days, do you? Just the physical part, not counting the other problem. And that made sense. Somebody else says it gets a little bit better every day. I didn't believe them, but I found that it did. But continuing on with these AA meetings, I can remember the fuzzy mind I had, that I couldn't remember the Lord's Prayer. I would mumble with them. I think it was 3 months before I ever said the Serenity Prayer accurately. I always got it backwards. And I remember during the period of silent meditation, the only thing that I could think of to say was, thank you, God. Thank you for this. I believe that sobriety is the most important thing in my life. Without it, I know I'd have nothing. I know that the disease is progressive. I know where I'd be if I make my choice the other way. I know that I have the choice to drink or not to drink. But I have found something else in AA, that sobriety is why I came. Sobriety is what I got, and sobriety is very important to me. But it's given me a whole new philosophy of life, a way of life, whatever you want to call it. My interests have changed. My values of what's important in my life have changed considerably. I'd always been ambitious in making money. I've been in that area. I'm in that area now, making money for other people. But to me, I like to have a decent home for Nancy and the kids to live in, and I want the girls to go to school as long as they'll go. I don't want them to make a career of it, but as long as they'll go. But outside of that, I don't have any ambitions like I used to have about having some of the things the other fella has. I used to be envious of people. This guy's got a boat, so I went out and bought a boat. I couldn't afford a big one. I bought a little one. We didn't have any groceries on the shelf, but Chuck was out buying a boat. I think the thing that bugged me was the guy next door had three children. He made about the same amount of money as I did. He had no more, no less problems than I did. And that guy could take two drinks before dinner, enjoy himself, and forget it. And I couldn't do it. I got drunk many times over that problem. Why can he do it, and why can't I do it? And I found that in AA that it didn't make any difference what caused it. That relieved my mind, not to worry about what caused it or when it happened. That it's happened, I forget about it. I believe that some people don't understand AA, and they know I'm in AA. And in Columbus, my anonymity isn't too much a secret because I've talked to civic clubs and other groups. I haven't violated any of the traditions of AA, but I don't hesitate to talk to groups that I think will help AA, period, or help an individual. And they say, "You still have to attend those meetings?" And I said, "Well, I really don't know." I said, "I can look back and think of what I was like and what it's like now." And I said, "The first place, I don't know whether I want to take a chance on it or not." But I said, "It isn't a thing of necessity with me today. It's a thing that I love. And if I go a week without attending an AA meeting, I feel like there's something lost out of my life, something that I can't replace." I average sometimes three or four meetings a week, sometimes two a week, occasionally one. But I never have been to an AA meeting that I didn't get something out of it. And it helped me grow just a little bit more. Today, when I read the 12 steps and try to study over the 12 steps, and I try to work this personal inventory and go back over it from time to time, and not to see if I've made progress, but to see where I still need to go. The 12 steps, every time that I really get seriously reading the 12 steps or discussing it in a meeting, they keep having new meanings to me every day. They have a new meaning to me today that they didn't have 6 months ago. The big book, and I read it on a Florida vacation this year again. I just took it along. I refer to it and look at it here and there, but I took it down and read the whole thing again. And I didn't think it was the same book that I read the last time. There are so many things in there that I got an altogether different interpretation of and angle on by reading it again. I think that probably a good idea of what's happened in my life and what's more important has happened in my family's life is that my son is in the service now. Before he left, the three children and Nancy and I used to get together in the den and we'd have a little sharing session. Sometimes it was a bitching session. We would throw out some things that we thought perhaps they weren't doing right. They could tell us some things, and we told them honestly, they can tell us some things that we're not doing right. And we'll have an honest discussion about it. And that we, sometimes any one of the five of us could bring up some personal problem in our lives that we can discuss, all of us. And then, quite often, when we end the session, anybody that wanted to say a prayer could say a prayer. And I don't know, I guess I'd been in AA about 2 years, perhaps, and we were having one of these sessions, and one of my daughters, it was her time to say a prayer, and I said, do you want to say something? She said, yeah. And I didn't know this was in her mind. She had never expressed it. But she said, God, thank God, I thank you for making my daddy an alcoholic. She says, because it's brought all of us closer together, and it's brought all of us closer to you. And that was out of a gal at that time was about 16 years old. And then I had some bloodshot eyes like I did after Debbie talked, because to me, that was what AA had meant to me in my life, because it had brought all of us closer together and brought all of us closer to God. And which is last but by far not the least, it's brought me together with so many, many wonderful people and wonderful friends. I thought I had friends before, and we all know about these boozing friends, but I mean that with you through thick and thin, when things get thick, they thin out. But I mean real friends that I have found in AA, and quite often this friendship has nothing to do with drinking. That you know that if you have a problem, you've got a friend that you can talk it over with and you'll get honest answer. Nancy mentioned that in the last couple of years we had had some problems within our family and what I would call crises. And the amazing thing, and I didn't realize it till it was all over, and when some of these came up, we talked about it, all the parties involved. We sought advice from disinterested parties, from AA friends. And then we arrived at a decision. And then we all lived with that decision. And after it was all over, this one particular thing that was very upsetting to me, when after it was all over, everybody in the family loved each other even more than they did before. Had I been drinking, God knows what would have happened. It would have been a catastrophe. But I didn't realize it till it was all over, that, and after it was all over, and the thing was as settled as it was ever going to be. It was the first time that anything like this has happened to me that I hadn't even thought about taking a drink. And I worry about progress and a lot of the things that I do that I know are wrong, and I bug myself because you're not making any progress. You say you are, but look at yourself honestly, you're not. But here, something had happened in my life, and I had been able to meet the crisis, and I think intelligently come to a decision with the help of other people, and taking a drink hadn't entered my life. And that's the one sign of progress that I know I've made, and I thank God and I thank you for it. I'd like to close with a little thing that I had read recently, and I've read a lot of stuff that Bill W. had written, and I have all the AA literature that I've been able to buy, borrow, or steal. But I had never, this had never registered with me before until I read it in the AA message. And if I were to honestly say what my ambitions are right this minute, he has expressed them. It says, true ambition is the profound desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. Bill Decker, thank you.